It's Philosophy Talk.
Right now, we're going back to the Olympic Stadium for the closing minutes of the philosophy final, and I understand that there's still no score.
The Greeks were really onto something, weren't they? Sports are serious philosophical business.
Plato's in goal, Socrates a front-runner there, and Aristotle as sweeper. Aristotle, very much the man in form.
Being an athlete means cultivating virtues of loyalty, collaboration, and discipline.
It also means cultivating feelings of rivalry, tribalism, and obsession.
Socrates is there! Socrates is in! Socrates has scored! The Greeks are going mad! The Greeks are going mad! Socrates scores! The beautiful cross from Archimedes, the Germans are disputing it! Hegel is arguing that the reality is merely an a priori adjunct of non-naturalistic ethics. Kant, by the categorical imperative, is holding that ontologically exists only in the imagination, and Marx is claiming it was offside.
Our guest is Heather Reed from Morningside College,
author of The Philosophical Athlete.
The Athlete as Philosopher.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help now more than ever.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Do sports cultivate virtues like discipline, self-knowledge, and wisdom?
Or do they just cultivate vices like aggression, greed, and brutality?
Are athletics a way to find ourselves or just a way to lose ourselves?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
And today, we're thinking about the athlete as philosopher.
Philosopher? I mean, look, Ken, I love watching Liverpool on the telly as much as the next person. I have a great time kicking the ball around once a week, but I don't see how that's going to make me a better thinker.
Well, Josh, that's because you're thinking in two contemporary terms. I mean, think about the ancients, like the ancient martial arts tradition of the East. Or think about the ancient Greeks and like Plato.
What about them?
Well, they thought philosophy was not just a set of ideas, but it was a way of life. And they also thought that athletic training helps you live and engage in that way of life.
Well, because it makes us stronger, fitter, healthier. That's the kind of thing. What's philosophical about that?
No, Josh, you're missing the point. I mean, it's much more than about health of the body. I mean, think about sports and what they do. They make us more disciplined, better equipped to deal with failure. Sports instills habits of focus and determination in us. It turns us into team players, and it gets us to value fairness. What's that? You Brits have a phrase about fairness. What's that?
Oh, you mean that's not cricket?
Right. That's all about if it's not cricket, it's not fair, right? So yeah.
Look, I just think you're moving way too fast, Ken. I mean, look, I'm not even convinced yet that being an athlete's entirely good, even for your health.
Oh, come on. What do you mean by that? Of course.
I mean, look, exercise is great, right? But once you start getting involved in competition, things can easily go too far, and pretty soon you're doing lifelong damage to your body.
Well, that is true. I mean, Earl Campbell, great running back, can't even walk now, and I wrestled through college, and I had 5 knee injuries in 5 years in a row. So, yeah, there is that. There's a downside. There's a downside to everything.
Right, and that's not even to mention the brain injuries that young people are getting from playing American football. What's that expression from Friday Night Lights? A clear eyes, full hearts, smashed heads?
No, that's not the phrase. No, that's not cricket. You're cheating. That wasn't the quote at all. And besides, you're ignoring the really good stuff that I was talking about earlier. Discipline, fairness, teamwork. What about that?
Yeah, look, that's absolutely true. I grant you that. I'm just saying that for every benefit of athletics, there's a corresponding downside. I mean, think about that collaboration with your teammates. Good, yes, but tends to go along with despising the players and fans of the other team, right? And that fairness, yeah, but haven't you heard about, steroid-taking baseball players, diving soccer players, and ball-deflating quarterbacks?
Okay, I heard about all those things. I have not been living in a sports cave, and I grant you sports aren't perfect, but nothing human is perfect, and great things are still possible, even within imperfect institutions. And we haven't even really talked about the greatest benefit of all.
What's
the greatest philosophical benefit? Well, every time you train, Every time you play, every time you get on the field, sports teaches you something. It teaches you something about yourself, about your limits, about your potential. Sports are nothing short, Josh, of like a confrontation with the self. That's profound.
Okay, that sounds like philosophy. I totally grant you that. But wouldn't you admit, Ken, that this school of self-knowledge doesn't always entirely do its work? I mean, you know, what about that guy, that racist guy, John Rocker? What about that not-so-entirely well-intentioned Tonya Harding?
Oh, you mean the misunderstood Tonya. Yeah, yeah. Look, Josh, for every Tonya Harding, there's a Serena Williams. For every John Rocker, but there's a LeBron James. And look, LeBron and Serena, they were both poor, underprivileged kids when they started out. And look at the amazing adults they've become today. They're great role models. They're socially engaged. And they're amazing athletes. And you know, athletics help them become who they are.
Yeah, you know, I grant you that. I think you're absolutely right.
So then you have to concede, too, that athletics is not just good for the individual. They can also help to make the world a better place.
Ken, you clearly see sports through rose-tinted spectacles.
Yeah, Josh, but you see them through Pete Rose-tinted spectacles.
Now, that's definitely not cricket, Ken. I'm not saying that sports are all bad. I'm just saying they're not all good.
Well, I agree with you there. Nothing human is all good. And to help us sort out the good from the bad, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to find out what popular culture has to tell us about the value of sports. She files this report.
Being perfect is not about that scoreboard out there.
In Friday Night Lights, the camera pans from Coach Gary Gaines to the players listening to him in the locker room with that stifled, vein-popping, furious look that means a teenage boy is having an emotion.
Being perfect is about being able to look your friends in the eye and know that you didn't let them down because you told them the truth. And that truth is that you did everything that you could. There wasn't one more thing that you could have done. If you can do that, gentlemen, then you're perfect.
According to this character and a zillion other locker room dramatizations, sports are not about winning. They're about something other than what they appear to be about. This is why you have to get philosophical, like Bruce Lee.
Empty your mind. Be formless, shapeless, like water.
In martial arts traditions, sports are really just exercises that teach us how to master ourselves in order to better approach life.
Now, you put water into a cup, it becomes the cup. You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Now, water can flow or it can crash. Be water, my friend.
I won't try to summarize the philosophies behind martial arts.
Show me wax on, wax off.
But in The Karate Kid, they have to do with hard work and patience in the face of life's mysteries and your own rookie incompetence.
Show me pin defense.
Pace! Pace! Death! Death!
Trusting that waxing your instructor's car and painting his house will pay off if he says it will. Compare that to the way the coach in Any Given Sunday, played by Al Pacino, talks to his players.
I pissed away all my money. Believe it or not, I chased off anyone who's ever loved me. And lately, I can't even stand the face I see in a mirror.
Here, sports are about redemption, the idea that no one's perfect, but what matters is making the most of a second chance.
Life's a game of inches. So is football. Because in either game, life or football, the margin for error is so small. I mean, one half a step too late or too early, and you don't quite make it. One half second too slow, too fast, you don't quite catch it. The inches we need are everywhere around us.
In team sports, redemption is crucially about making it up to your comrades. The ultimate idea is that the most meaningful achievements are the ones that take a whole team.
Either we heal now as a team, or we will die as individuals.
But not all athletes think of sport as a metaphor or an exercise that teaches us about life.
The wire is a safe place for me to be. The street is not, life is not.
This is Philippe Petit, the gymnast famous for walking a wire strung up between the World Trade Center towers.
It's a rigorous and simple path. It's straight. There are no bad guys, no politicians, no representative authorities.
For Petit, sports are a way to transcend.
There is no life. There is something much more supreme than life. There is carrying one's life across. It's the most beautiful profession in the world.
Not because transcending is easier than real life, but because in sport, the struggle and the risk are on your own terms. You can take life into your own hands. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks very much, Liza. That was a fantastic piece and quite uplifting, if you'll forgive the pun. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ken Taylor. And today we're thinking about philosophy and athletics.
We're joined now by Heather Reed. She's a professor of philosophy at Morningside College. She's author of The Philosophical Athlete and also Introduction to the Philosophy of Sport. Heather, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Heather, how did you first get interested in this subject? I mean, were you an athlete in college like Ken, or are you more of an amateur like me?
Well, I was a cyclist, which wasn't a collegiate sport. And in fact, back in the 80s when I went to college, there weren't that many women's sports that were played in college. But I was a pretty serious athlete, and like a lot of people, I wanted to make the Olympic team.
Oh, that's cool. Did you?
No, well, I made it to the Olympic trials in 1984, which is the first time they had the final Olympic trials, the first time they had women cycling in the Olympics. And I decided after I graduated in 86 that I was going to go all out for the 1988 Olympic team.
Well, you know, Heather, my wrestling career ended through knee injuries, but I had hoped to make the Olympics, so I know how much passion and devotion that takes. So, but anyway, Josh and I were arguing earlier about whether ancient ideals have any relevance whatsoever today when it comes to athletics. I think they do. I'm not sure what Josh thinks. What do you think?
Well, I hope they do. I mean, I think that like any kind of practice, any human practice, whether it's sports or religion or music, you can do it in a way that makes you a better person or you can do it in a way that doesn't. And I think that the ancient ideals help make athletics something that we can put in the service of becoming a better person.
That seems right to me. But can you just say a little bit more about what kinds of ideals you have in mind?
Well, especially in ancient philosophy, both ancient Greek philosophy and ancient Chinese philosophy, the key concept is virtue, is becoming the best kind of person you can be, the idea of human excellence. And the Greeks called it arete. And because a human being had both an intellect and physical capacities and all these other things, becoming excellent meant becoming excellent in every way.
I agree with you, but, you know, sports these days, kids specialize really early. They do sports to the exclusion of other things. My son started playing sports when he was very young, but started focusing on baseball when he was 11 mm-hmm. years old. Lots of young kids get lots of injuries, something Josh was missing. I mean, more Tommy John surgeries are performed on 14-year-olds and on major league pitchers these days. So are we really doing this in a way that promotes human excellence? Are we really doing that? Are we even close to doing that?
I think we're oftentimes not even asking ourselves why we're doing that. A lot of times, if you try to specialize a child very early on, you're probably thinking that this is the way for them to become a really great athlete, right? And maybe you're also hoping that they'll get a college scholarship or maybe a professional contract. But if you look at those things rationally, the chances are really low. And meanwhile, you can be selling out the actual idea of arete, the idea of human excellence, because they end up not having other skills and abilities.
So it sounds like you're appealing to an Aristotelian notion of excellence, which involves a balance. A nice middle
absolutely.
Path. Yeah. Okay, well, you know, we're going to keep talking about this as we go on. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the athlete as philosopher with Heather Reed from Morningside College.
Have sports today become impossibly corrupt? Or is there still space, however small, for athletes to learn about themselves and become better human beings through sports? Can athletes still live philosophical lives?
Athletics, the Ancients, and Altruism, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Do sports just teach us to be prowling tigers, or can they help us become something more? I'm Josh Landy, and you're listening to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we're thinking about philosophy and athletics. Our guest is Heather Reed from Morningside College. She's the author of The Philosophical Athlete.
So, Heather, Ken and you were saying earlier on that ancient ideals are still alive and relevant today, but, you know, some people might worry that rampant commercialism is sort of destroying the capacity for that, right? It's turning sport into a business, players into mercenaries, fans like me into saps. So, you know, is there still space for that Greek arete, that virtue you were talking about earlier?
I really think that there is. And I don't think it's so much that money itself and sponsorship is the culprit. The culprit is really the idea that the only value we can gain through sport is financial value. Mm. And it's actually the sponsors don't think of it that way. Obviously, they're putting money into the sport, so they think they're getting something else out of their advertising other than more profit. Whereas a lot of athletes say, well, I'm just playing sport to hope to make money someday.
Well, I want to challenge you a little bit. I mean, I love athletics. I spend a lot of my life pursuing it. I encourage my son to pursue it, right? But there is this commodification, this capitalist commodification of sport. I mean, these guys and women, mostly the guys, but in areas like tennis, even the women, right, are big business. They are big, huge business. Their branding business, we follow their every move, and it's all about this commodification. And doesn't that change it from a theater? I mean, underlying it is this capitalist commodification, which bound to have a corrupting influence. Don't you agree, or do you disagree, or what?
I think it corrupts, like I said, in the sense that it makes the individual practitioners think that the reason that they must be doing this is so that they can make more money, whereas the chance of making a lot of money in sport is really small, right. Whereas the chance of getting other kind of benefits is quite good. And so the real corruption is just from us thinking that what sports is all about is making money.
Yeah, but let's think about how far down that corruption trickles, right? It trickles right down to college athletics. Because when you get to be a D1 athlete, you start to believe, well, maybe I am going to get that, especially a D1 athlete in the big revenue sports, basketball and football, to a certain extent, baseball. I'm going to get drafted into the majors, right? I mean, even at the D1 level. But you think, but then I want to try and get to that D1 level. That you're in high school. You think, I want to be a D1 athlete, and then I want to get drafted into the majors. And, you know, why did my 11-year-old son start so intensely love baseball? He did just love the game, and he was really good at it. But there was this thought in the back of his mind, and I got to admit our mind, if he gets seen by the right people, then eventually he'll be a star in high school, and he'll get recruited by a D1 school and the whole thing. I mean,
and you might even think, Ken, I mean, to agree with you, even if an individual player doesn't think my future is making money through sports, they might be entering an institutional framework where there's a certain amount of corruption. So you think about the NCAA, all these cheating scandals, all these awful coaches, and a kind of culture of cover-up and corruption. So I don't want to be too much of a downer. I mean, I agree with you, Heather, that these ancient ideals are alive, but aren't they a little bit in peril?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that especially when you talk about the problems with institutions, and if we look at intercollegiate sport, especially at the very high Division I level, those programs themselves are even thought about by the university in terms of profit, in terms of recruiting students, in terms of bringing in dollars from donors. And so how are we going to expect athletes to have other values in playing sport if the institutions that promote their sport only care about money and are right. only using them to make money?
So how do we do? Okay, so answer your question. So, you know, I just was watching the Little League World Series on ESPN, and those kids play that game with such delight, such utter delight. And the coach from Hawaii, it seems like a great guy, the kind of guy I would have willingly entrusted my kid to in his formative years, right? Because he was really encouraging. And I used to belong to this thing when I coached baseball called the Alliance for Positive Coaching, which was about empowering kids, you know, and all that. So, but there's a lot of forces out there. So I'm just wondering, how do you get a young athlete and maybe the parents of that young athlete to, like, resist those forces? I mean, How's that work? And to focus on this theater, what did you call it? The school of the self or something like that, Josh called it. I really believe that, the school of the self metaphor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think I called it that. No, you criticized me for believing that the school of the self was real.
But I believe in it.
Well, I think that the sporting experience still is a school of the self, and that individual athletes, when they face the challenge of having to perform in sport, are going to learn about themselves.
Yeah.
But what we forget to do is we forget to talk. We don't create a space where we talk about what we've learned from our sporting experience. So when I teach my course in philosophy of sport, I provide that space. And it's amazing what these athletes talk about. And their most meaningful experience often isn't winning. Their most meaningful experience often is when they were injured or when they failed or something like that.
So let's focus on the idea of sports as a school of the self. Let's talk about that for a while, and we'll block out the ugliness that comes from the commodification of sports. We'll come back to that. But tell me more about how you think. I mean, I do think of athletics as a theater of self-cultivation, right? So tell me more about how athletics works as a theater of self-cultivation.
Well, I think that one of the first things that I actually think that athletics can be thought of like philosophy in the sense that it's a truth-seeking activity. So one of the first things that happens in philosophy is we start with a question. And to have a question means you don't know the answer. So when you stand on the starting line of, say, a 100-meter race, you don't really, it's like a question. You don't have an answer of, can you run fast enough to beat the next person? How fast can you go? And so it begins in a question, and then it seeks out to learn something about what I can do.
Right. And it sounds like you were also suggesting it's a kind of a productive encounter with failure. So it's not just about what I can do.
Absolutely.
It's also about what I can't do and how I can develop a kind of a resilience or a coping strategy or something
and
like that.
And what I can't do now, but may be able to help myself to do, right?
Right. Well, and that what I can't do is the destruction of the illusion. It's like the Socratic, when Socrates talks in the Platonic dialogues, he's always refuting the answers that the interlocutors give. And you realize that what you thought was the case is not the case. So you have to find out what you can't do and then deal with that loss, that shattered illusion. And then as Josh was saying, then maybe you start to think, well, you know, maybe I can get closer to this. Maybe I can create a program to find or to be the faster athlete that I want to be.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about philosophy and athletics with Heather Reed from Morningside College. We've got Pat on the line from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Pat. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. Well, like a lot of parents, we told our two boys, you can pick the sport, but when you're fifth and sixth graders, we want you to join a team sport for at least 2 years. We were following a brother and sister-in-law's model. So we took them to all kind of little classes when they were younger. But we thought, isn't there something different that you get from team sports? I'm interested in knowing your ideas and what the ancients thought, you know, cycling versus a baseball team. Is there something your child's really getting that's different when they join a team sport?
That's
my answer off the line.
Okay, that's a wonderful question, Pat. What do you think, Heather? Because you know you were a cyclist. That's a solo. Well, I mean, obviously you're not necessarily doing it just on your own, but it's not a team sport. Are there important differences here?
Well, it is a team sport and an individual sport at the same time.
Right.
And I think that they both have their benefits. But the individual benefits, that confrontation with yourself and with failure, happens in team sports too. So if you think of throwing a free throw in basketball, you are pretty isolated and alone at that moment, even though you're playing a team sport. So those moments are in team sports as well as individual sports. An advantage that team sports brings that just individual sports might not is that you have to learn to find your place in the group, to work with others in order to achieve a collective goal.
Right.
So that is something that's really important educationally. Of course, we find that in individual sports too, because really you're working with other. Even your competitors, in a way, are working with you to make you a better athlete. So the social aspect is important.
And it's important that many sports are a combination of team and individual. So I wrestled, right? And you might think, well, that's an individual sport. Well, there are tournaments that I entered as an individual, but there are also the team.
Wrestling teams.
And that matters, right? Because here's the thing. When you're on a wrestling team, if you can beat your opponent, by more points. You score more points for the team, and so you are incentivized to give more for the team. If you were just yourself, you'd think, I'd settle for the victory, but I want the pin, right? And why do I want the pin? Because my team is this many points behind. So, and baseball. It's like a team sport, but it's a coordinated set of individual moments in which you are on the hook, right, for this. Only you can make that play, right? You can't pass it off to somebody else. Only you take this at bat. Right. So I think many sports interweave.
They have the combination.
They have the combination.
Can I want to come back to something Heather just said? I think it's really interesting because, you know, something you might think about right away is teamwork, collaboration, and so on. But I really like your idea, Heather, that it's also about a certain kind of interaction with the opponent. Right. And we can learn something for life from a kind of respectful. I mean, I was thinking, you know, there's another Greek word we could throw around, the agon. Right. This kind of rivalrous competition in which everyone raises their game and it's ultimately mutually beneficial rather than being violent or confrontational or antagonistic.
Absolutely. And the idea is that the root of agon is the same root as the word agora, which means the gathering place or marketplace. And so agon means to struggle together, to come together. And you have to respect your opponent and you have to treat your opponent as an individual like you under the rules. And this is also really good for young people to look at the opponent no matter what gender, what color, what social status this person might have, they are a human opponent. And so it helps us to look at other people as fellow human beings.
Right. In some ways, even though sports is highly competitive, it's also deeply cooperative in its competitiveness, because it's true that, you know, I once heard LeBron James, he's heavily involved in the NBA Players Union. And somebody asked him, look, LeBron, you've got this multi-million, you're going to get yours no matter what. And he said, you have to understand, the NBA players, we're a band of brothers. Mm. We compete like crazy, but, you know, in the offseason, we work out together. We're all trying to improve the game. We're all trying to push ourselves together. We are a band of brothers. And I think there's a deep truth to that.
Yeah.
Right. And in any sort of sport, this thing where you respect the opponent but compete like heck against the opponent, I think that's an important element of it.
Yeah, and maybe it's yeah, go ahead, Heather.
I was going to say that there's something that the Greeks understood about erete, individual excellence, that I think we forget in the modern time, is that's always in a context of community. And so your excellence has to benefit your community, and your excellence also has to be something that benefits everyone. So in the Olympic Games, it was really, the ancient Olympic Games were a religious festival that was designed to please the god for the benefit of everyone there. Yeah. So a good athlete, like your example of LeBron James. Thinks of himself as a member of a team, even if it's not specifically a athletic team.
That's great. Yeah, we have another caller on the line. It's Ed from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ed. What's your comment?
Okay, I think I'm going to talk about the long-term effects of doing this. I was a pretty good high school basketball player, and I was best at water skiing, but I didn't compete. But, I mean, I've done this. I actually enjoyed playing basketball with a team, but I actually enjoyed pickup games much more when there wasn't the pressure necessarily to win. This had all the aspects of friendship, and you still wanted to win, but, you know, it just wasn't that outside pressure. But the long-term effect is I've done something like this all my life. You know, I went from, right. I quit basketball after my knees gave out, and I go swimming, and I've taken up Qigong and Tai Chi and yoga recently. And, you know, I'm 73 years old, and I don't believe the shape I'm in. I mean, I didn't, just the long-term physical condition in my mind. I was taught that people my age were elderly and over the hill, and I'm not, you know.
Well, that's good, Ed. I'm glad for you.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's another aspect of sports that I think Aristotle mentioned, that it was good for the mind, you know.
Thanks a lot, Ed. You got a comment? You got a comment on that, Heather?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think what Ed's thinking about is where Plato's Republic, Socrates says that the main purpose of athletics is for the benefit of the soul or the mind. And not specifically the body. He says, it's not the body like everyone thinks, right. It's really the soul. And that's because the soul or the mind is what moves the body. So moving your body is really sports. You know, we talk about it being physical, but it's not physical. It's about moving. It's about voluntary movement. So your mind and your soul are always involved in that. So Ed really represents arete in the sense that it's the excellence of a human being, and human beings have bodies and they move them. And by keeping moving his body through sports, he's able to achieve arete even in his old age.
That is true. I don't want to downplay what Ed says, but I did have my knee surgery when I was 28. And like I said, I had many knee injuries in my sport. And the doctor told me, Taylor, you got the knees of a 65-year-old man. And you can't forget what Josh referred to in the opening, the long-term damage to some of these football players. It's true. Medical sports science, sports medicine has gotten better. When I had my first torn cartilage, it was before the days of arthroscopic surgery, and the doctor said, well, we'll take it at the end of the season, because if we did, they had to go in and cut you, and it would be long-term rehabilitation. Now you get it for a torn meniscus, you get scoped out, you're back in a few weeks, it's no big deal. But there is, for certain sports, very severe damage to the body that can pile up over the years, and so there is that downside.
But in some ways, if we were to eliminate all of the injuries and eliminate all of the risk of injury, we would lose a profound part of the educational part of sport, which is kind of learning our limits and learning that you can't go all out, that there are limits and that you've got to deal with them, that you have to rehabilitate these injuries. I mean, certainly the things like the head injuries, which have these horrible long-term consequences, are serious, and we got to do whatever we can to try to eliminate those. But other things, some of the arm and leg injuries that young athletes endure actually might be part of the educational effect of sport.
Yeah, but I don't know what a 14-year-old pitcher learns from having Tommy John surgery. I don't really know what a 14.
That's a high price of an education, right?
Maybe the wrong thing.
Can I come back to something? I loved what you were saying before about the relationship to society. I think that's really powerful, this notion, right? That it's always in a context. And you got these amazing figures like LeBron James, Serena Williams. You've got these role models. These people are using their platform to protest injustice, all these wonderful things. But just playing devil's advocate, can we also see the flip side of that? I mean, so take one example. Around some male sports, there's a culture of toxic masculinity that seems to grow around them. I don't know if it's inevitable or not, but aren't there sometimes some negative social effects as well as the positive ones?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's why we have to think about what we're doing with sports. Sports are human constructions. We can make of them and do with them whatever we want as human beings. So we have to be really careful. Are we using it just to enforce certain things like obedience and hypermasculinity and imperviousness to pain that will make these young men easily exploited by somebody for their own purposes? That's not what we want, right? So we have to look at how we practice them. And I don't think sports reliably reward virtues. They try to, they should, but sometimes they reward vices. Right. And so you have to be really careful about what's being rewarded in sport. And also sometimes, you got to say sometimes people win, but they win ugly. They win in a way that wasn't virtuous. And then that doesn't have value, or we shouldn't socially see it as value.
I agree. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. And today we're thinking about philosophy and athletics with Heather Reed from Morningside College.
What can we do to make sports more of a space for virtue and less of a haven for vice? How can we reform our leagues, our training camps, our educational system to make all athletes able to live truly philosophical lives?
Training a new breed of philosopher athletes when Philosophy Talk continues. Should a well-lived life include the sporting life? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Heather Reed from Morningside College, and we're thinking about the athlete as, get this, philosopher.
And I feel like we were all agreeing that sports today aren't entirely perfect, right? They aren't in every case living up to those ancient models. So let's get back to the question of what we can do to make things better. What do you think, Heather?
Well, I think the first thing is we need to reintegrate especially at the educational level, the sporting experience with the intellectual experience. I mean, I teach ethics. I do it in a classroom. Ethics is about how we act. Why not have a class where you play sports and then you talk afterward about the ethical implications of certain actions? You know,
right.
Why did you help somebody up? And so we can reintegrate the philosophical side of sports with the physical sides of sports, which is what the ancient Greek gymnasium did.
That means that coaches need to be like teachers of young men and women. And to some of them are like that. But I got to tell you, I've seen a lot of coaches. I've had a lot of coaches. I think of some of my coaches, some of my son's coaches, as what I call small men with big problems.
Oh boy!
Right, and this like in high school sports, for some reason, well, I know why. Because the teams want to win. In high school varsity, you want to win, right? The coach gets rewarded for winning. They don't get rewarded for teaching these young men to be better young men. I mean, they just don't. If it's a side benefit, right? They would. But if they were losers, but they made the kids better young men and women, you know. So how do you re-incentivize? What structure of incentives can you introduce into this world of coaching and all this?
Well, first of all, you don't hire and fire coaches slowly by their win-loss record, especially
right.
at the lower levels. And second, the training that we give to coaches should have training in ethical education and other things that the coaches can learn. Also, it shouldn't be only coaches that are talking about sports and are involved in our students' athletic lives. There are other teachers, we philosophers, should know what's going on and help them to learn from their sporting experience.
Yeah, maybe every team should have a
philosopher?
A resident philosopher.
That's a great idea.
We're going to go to another caller. We have Anthony on the line from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anthony.
Good morning. Really interesting conversation. I assume that all of the athletes in an ancient Greek gymnasium would have been the sons of citizens. And we live in a society where there's a huge reality of economic and racial inequality, and we see that playing out in sports.
Yeah.
And I wonder, how does that play into the virtue or lack of virtue of sports?
That's a really good question, Anthony. I'm going to add a little twist to it, Heather, before we turn it over to you, because I think Anthony's right about the ancient Greeks, but I think in ancient Rome, a lot of those athletes would have been slaves and non-citizens. Am I right or wrong about that? But anyway, what do you think about Anthony's question?
Well, I mean, the specific question about in ancient Rome, whether a lot of the athletes were slaves, is that it's true. Specifically to Anthony's question, I think the question of how sports deals with inequality is really interesting because sport, as I said, in terms of the rules, treats each athlete as an individual and as equally. It is also a space where a lot of times, especially young people who are socioeconomically in completely different neighborhoods, completely different upbringings, they come together. And sometimes they come together on the same team, but sometimes they come together as competitors, and they're forced to see each other as equals. And a lot of times the stereotypes that you were brought up with kind of have to be left at the side of the court in order to play the game.
Yeah, that's true. But here's something that's, again, since I spent so much time trying to get my son recruited in baseball, and he actually was a college baseball player but quit after a year because he got a load of what college athletes is really like. But I spent so much time. Here's the thing about baseball. I don't know about other sports as close up. It really has become the province of the middle class and upper middle class because there are these elite travel teams, there are these elite tournaments, and it costs lot of money.
Right.
Right? There's private, all the kids take private lessons with, my son had a hitting coach, a strength and conditioning coach, an outfield coach. I mean, this is an expensive proposition. And sports are again, at least some sports are again becoming the province of an elite.
And I think that's intentionally on the part of the elite, maybe not consciously. But if you look at history, the ancient Olympic Games allowed people from the lower classes to demonstrate publicly that they had more athletic virtue than the aristocrats. So the aristocrats invented horse races, which were very expensive, so that they could win the horse races if they couldn't win the running and the wrestling match. And then they brought in specialized doctors, specialized trainers. So what happens is the elite always tries to use the advantages they have, usually financial advantages, but also political advantages, in order to reinforce their status. So I think that what you're talking about with all of the costs to become excellent in sports is something we should really try and eliminate, because that undermines sports' ability to do the kind of social work to kind of bridge the differences between the classes that it can do.
But I feel like there are some disturbing things. I've thought a lot about CTEs, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, these injuries that football players are suffering even when they don't get concussions. And that to me is already disturbing enough. But when you think about the racial component too, then the analogy to the gladiatorial arena becomes really disturbing, at least to me. You know, we're sitting here comfortably in our seats watching people entertain us at the cost of their own bodies and brains.
Yeah, the dehumanization of athletes in general also can have kind of a racial tinge to it when you say, oh, well, you know, like you'll hear people say, well, they're earning a lot of money from that. Well,
right.
you know, people may earn a lot of money from other kinds of dangerous jobs, but it doesn't make it right, especially when it's an unnecessary risk.
Right. I mean, right. I think this class dynamics is really complicated. I said, like, baseball is becoming the province of the elite because of the expenditure. But there is something else I've noticed, true. I don't want to overgeneralize, but like a lot of basketball players are from the inner city. A lot of football players are from the inner city. I mean, these are very demanding sports that are hard to get really good at and require a lot of sacrifice. You say, why is that? Why is like the racial composition of the NBA and the NFL so different from the racial composition of baseball? There's complicated things about it. One of the moving out of parks, baseball fields out of the cities into the suburbs. But there's this other thing, like this brutal sport of football. There's a lot of upper middle class parents who don't want their sons to play this brutal sport. But football holds out a promise of great wealth if you're willing to put up with the possibility of injury and all that sort of stuff. And I'm sure there must be a racialized component to the assessment of risk and reward in that. So we do end up with, you know, black NFL players being watched by white spectators in this kind of gladiatorial thing with a great class division between the audience and the participants. And that's I think that's a fraught thing.
Yeah.
It's a double-edged sword, though, too, because when a group, whether it's Rome, a community like Rome or a university, associates athletic excellence with virtue, when the people that are displaying that virtue are not part of the normal class, and really most of our universities before college athletics had a much lower percentage of students of color, especially from poor students from the inner city, they have to face up to the fact that virtue may not be a matter of class. So it helps, but it also hurts. And I do think that the idea when people say, well, you know, they should be subject to these kinds of unnecessary risks because, you know, they're poor. I mean, they don't say it that clearly, but sometimes that seems to be what's going on in the back of people's heads.
Right. Well, shifting gears, we've got a couple of really interesting comments here through email. So John from Berkeley says that the heart of the spirit of sports is the specific. You know, there's only one the catch. There's only one triple crown winning run by Secretariat. So the grand generalization sought by philosophers are oppositional to sports virtues.
He's attributing that to Paul Weiss, not to himself.
Thank you. Yeah. And then another comment from Aham we got through Facebook. What about Schopenhauer's notion that the optimal connection we have with ultimate reality and the will is through the body? So great, really fascinating.
Do you want to take one
of those?
Well, I mean, they're both good. I mean, I do think the question of Schopenhauer's point about the connection with sort of transcending oneself through the body, I do think that there's something there, that there's something about the lived experience of sport and the lived questioning of oneself and the lived experience of having time change when somebody has an experience like the zone are ways of learning qualitatively different from the kind of learning that we get in conventional academics. Yeah. And so that there's something there.
So I want to, but what about the Paul Weiss point of the singular, the sports defined by its ability to produce these singular moments of I assume grace and beauty, and not just by the ordinary grind.
Steven Gerrard's goal against West Ham.
Right.
FA
what
Cup.
About that?
Well, I do think that those are the kinds of moments that attract us and galvanize us. In the ancient Greek Olympics, which, as I said, were a religious festival, I think when an athlete had a moment of excellence, what would happen is that the audience would interpret it as an epiphany, as an appearance of the god. So the guy that's running the 100 meters and he just has this incredible event like Usain Bolt did in Beijing. The people see that as sort of the appearance of Hermes or of Achilles, and they see this kind of collapsing of time that creates a special experience. And I do think sports brings that in.
So sports is even more than a theater of self-cultivation. It's potentially a theater of transcendence, right? And transcendence is rare and unsystematic, but that makes it even more philosophical.
Yes, and more human. I mean, that's the thing about it. If we get too caught up in winning and too caught up especially in the technology of sports, we forget that it's all about the human experience. And certainly experience of transcendence and ideas of divinity are very much part of the human experience. And they're there in sports.
That is a fantastic place to leave the conversation. Heather, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Our guest has been Heather Reed, professor of philosophy at Morningside College and author of The Philosophical Athlete. So Ken, what's your thinking now?
Well, I think this is a really cool topic. I mean, we started out thinking sports as a theater of self-cultivation, which I think is really important and really true and a deep fact about it. I have in my old age, my declining age or something, I have come to love athletes who are utterly dedicated to their craft.
Yeah.
I really admire LeBron James because when you hear him talk about his dedication to his craft, it's amazing. And then this last thought that we had, that sports are a theater of transcendence. That's really good. I mean, that's
fantastic.
There aren't many realms which offer humans up transcendence. Right. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, when I started thinking about this, I was thinking about the Iliad and Antilochus, like already in the earliest work of literature we got in the West. There's cheating in sports.
There's
cheating in a chariot. But I want to leave. But no, I mean, that's not the end of sport. That's not the only thing. It is a theater for self-transformation, self-understanding, and transcendence. Why not? Getting in this flow state in the zone, there's nothing like that.
Right.
So this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where, with apologies to Descartes, our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can also become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might just feature it on our blog. Now, if fast talking were an Olympic sport, this guy would have multiple gold medals. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, we've come a long way since ancient Greece, haven't we? It was the birthplace of both philosophy and sport. Classic philosophy, of course. Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, who some believe had been a wrestler in his youth. And Olympic sport, where athletic prowess was deemed an indicator of leadership ability and one's personal potential could actually be measured in athletic competitions. Sport was considered a moral education for men, of course, though women could play too, just not with the boys. These days, sport has taken over education. That is, many centers of higher learning have stadiums bigger than four community colleges laid end to end, with room left over for Trump University. The liberal arts are shrinking. Philosophy, unless it's tied in with economics or tech, is one more class for a freshman to stumble through on his way to becoming an adult and making hopeless attempts at debt reduction. Not that sport itself is such a golden career. Doping has ruined many an athletic prospect. There's the shameless exploitation of student players unpaid while the NCAA rakes in billions. And what about professional athletes over the hill at 30? Knees and hips gone, athletes limp into a stunted adulthood of restaurant ownership, car dealerships, and celebrity endorsements of dodgy insurance options. As the Greeks showed, athletics and philosophy were once ethical guideposts. Now we consider them to be driven by jocks and nerds overseen by judgmental dolts. The actual world is run by armchair quarterbacks and armchair philosophers. Instead of debates, we have hearings. Instead of athletic events, we have championship seasons. Instead of thought, we have sense. Instead of flights to Olympus, we have hell in a handcart. Has been thus since the death of Socrates, but perhaps the twain could meet again, sport and philosophy. I've never seen any buff philosophers with legs bigger than my torso and the ability to hurl steel girders over goalposts or reading Plato in Greek. I have seen slim philosophers, though, who look like they might swim or play tennis or bike, maybe if you squint on doctor's orders, but I never think of philosophers as fit. And they don't pose in swimsuits, showing their six-packs, abs, or sinuous thighs, women especially, which also puts a different spin on sport. It's a manly virtue sport, still, by and large. Jockey women philosophers could open the door to croquet, golf, billiards. Civilized sport, like baseball, the most intellectual sport, because it depends so much on a kind of scholarship, the arcana of RBIs, stats, at-bats, extra innings. Every game is an eye in the record books, where the perfect game is one where nobody hits the ball. Bit much for me. But then my idea of sport is a brisk walk to the bar. If there were teams of philosophers banding together to compete in sporting events, that would be interesting. But wouldn't they need cheerleaders? Who'd be willing to do that? Team center forward guard, hit him again, hit him hard. The notion itself could become problematic. Is now indeed the right time to hit him hard? Maybe we need a feasibility study. Let's have a symposium instead. Little wine, little conversation. Some of those stuffed mushrooms, yum, we'll hit them hard later, after we've thought about it a bit. See how basketball fits into the grid of epistemology. See what I'm saying? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Sports, say the ancient Greeks, is morally serious because mankind's noblest aim is the loving contemplation of worthy things. That's an excerpt from my new book on baseball entitled Men at Work. And I would say it's particularly apropos in light of today's Expo Padre game.